headlines this hour. Iran's president tells resistance leaders in Damascus that the Palestinian cause remains the main priority in the Islamic Republic's foreign policies. Palestinian resistance groups strongly condemn the latest killings by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank. Plus, Russia accuses the U.S. and Ukraine of being behind a drone strike on the Kremlin, saying that it reserves the right to respond to sabotage attacks. This is news. Thanks for joining us. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi says that he believes that the collapse of the Israeli regime is imminent, as the signs are more visible now. Raisi, who is on an official visit to Syria, made the remarks while meeting with the leaders of resistance groups in Damascus. He said the Israeli regime has effortlessly tried to make Palestinians believe that their fate lies in the hands of occupiers. But the notion, Raisi added, is far from the truth, because Palestinian fighters are the ones who have the upper hand on the ground. The Iranian president reassured the leaders of resistance groups, including the Islamic Jihad and Hamas, that the Palestinian cause remains the main priority in the Islamic Republic's foreign policies. President Ebrahim Raisi says his visit to Syria is a turning point in relations between Iran and the Arab country. Speaking at a press conference in Damascus, Raisi said countries targeted by Western sanctions must cooperate to neutralize the bans. He said the Iranian people managed to turn the threat of sanctions into an opportunity. Raisi said Tehran is ready to share experiences with Damascus. He said that Iran and Syria are willing to expand cooperation in various fields, particularly in trade and the economy. Raisi said in his discussions with President Bashar al-Assad that he underscored the need to facilitate trade. The Iranian president said the two countries need to explore all potential fields of mutual cooperation.
Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi has arrived in Damascus for a historic visit aimed at boosting bilateral ties as Syria has launched the reconstruction season after more than a decade of war with foreign-backed terrorist groups. He was greeted at Damascus International Airport on Wednesday by Syrian Minister of Economy and Foreign Trade Mohammed Samer Al-Khalil. Raisi has attended an official welcoming ceremony held by his Syrian counterpart Bashar al-Assad. The visit is the first by an Iranian president since the foreign-backed militancy gripped the Arab country in 2011. President Raisi is accompanied by high-ranking delegation, including ministers of foreign affairs, roads and urban development, petroleum and economic affairs, and Iran's central bank chief. Officials have said that the visit is a sign of the Islamic Republic of Iran's strategic victory in the region. Iran and Syria have signed several agreements during Raisi's visit, some of which are centered around expanding economic cooperation. Economic ties are high on the agenda.
When the war against Syria was launched 12 years ago, Iran did not hesitate to provide political and economic support to Syria, despite threats and even offered blood. And blood is the most valuable thing that a human can offer his brother.
Iran and Syria have had successful cooperation in various fields such as security and the fight against terrorism. Just like the effective and decisive cooperation in the fight against terrorism, the two countries can now stand together in the construction season, taking into account Iran's engineering capabilities and capacities. Iran has expressed its readiness to help the Syrian nation and government pass through the post-war era.
We hope that the Iranian president's visit to Syria will benefit both countries. Our economy is in a bad state at the moment. We hope that this visit will not only deepen the relationship between the two countries, but also help cope with the American sanctions and strengthen the relationship with other countries.
Tehran and Damascus have stood by each other in difficult times and maintained cordial relations over the past 44 years. Iran maintains an advisory mission in Syria at the request of Damascus with the aim of helping the war-torn Arab country get rid of the foreign-backed militants who have been fighting against the democratically elected Syrian government since 2011. Iran's advisory assistance helped Syria defeat Daesh and win back control of almost all regions from terrorists.
Tehran and Damascus have enjoyed cordial relations for decades. Iran has given its unwavering support to Syria since the beginning of the crisis. It has also sent military advisors at the request of the Syrian government. Tehran has also expressed readiness to help with reconstruction efforts in Syria.
Syria and Iran are strategic allies. Syria is usually called Iran's closest ally. Syria cooperates with Iran in sending arms to resistance groups, including Hamas and Hezbollah. Relations between Syria and Iran improved after the Iranian Revolution in 1979. Syria was the first Arab state to recognize the Islamic Republic, founded in February 1979. During the Iran-Iraq War, Syria sided with Iran against Iraq and was isolated by Saudi Arabia and some of the Arab countries. President Raisi's current trip is taking place after more than a decade of turmoil in the Middle East, which included the war in Syria, the war in Yemen, the rise of ISIL, and the propagation of terrorism.
For 12 years, the oppressed people hatched conspiracies and committed sedition, gave easy money to Daesh and Takfiri terrorist groups, used media empires to conduct psychological warfare, inflicted damage, destroyed homes, killed children, and made women homeless. For 12 years, the U.S., Israel, and their pet Takfiri Daesh terrorist groups committed crimes in Syria. But Syria is standing strong today.
The Iranian president's visit to Syria has reportedly ruffled some feathers within the ranks of the Israeli regime. Israeli media have expressed concern about Raisi's trip, saying the visit is exceptional and that Israeli authorities should be concerned. Israel has carried out scores of attacks on government-controlled areas of Syria in recent years and many attacks in recent months. The timing of the visit makes it all the more important because of changes happening in the region.
Americans and Europeans still insist on their sanctions on Syria, and they have stressed that they would not allow any of those countries to invest anything in the government-held areas in Syria. Iran, Russia, China, as well as some other Arab League members, they are going to take part in the reconstruction. That means a big no to the United States policy. That would, I believe, end up in another failure for the U.S. sanctions policy.
Iran and Saudi Arabia plan to open embassies in each other's countries within days after agreeing last month to normalize relations under a deal brokered by China. Meanwhile, some Arab countries are normalizing relations with Damascus after years of joining the U.S. in backing rebel fighters in a failed regime change campaign against Syrian President Bashar al-Assad.
The Iranian nation is mourning the martyrdom of Hamid Reza al-Daghi, a man who lost his life while defending two members of the community against hooligans. His death has once again unified the Iranian nation and showed that Iranians' zeal for protecting the oppressed is within every particle of their soul.
Heroes do not only exist in stories. Some of them are among us and remind us of the fact that chivalry is not dead yet. Hamid Reza al-Daghi is one of them. The Iranian nation is mourning his death after he was brutally stabbed in the back and chest while defending two girls against a number of knife-wielding thugs in one of the streets of the northeastern city of Sabzavar. He later succumbed to his wounds in the hospital. Thousands of people from different walks of life took part in his funeral, hailing him as the martyr of courage and a brave national hero. His wife says he acted based on his zeal for defending the oppressed.
This could have happened anywhere else. My husband defended an oppressed person and fought until the last breath. This is the ultimate bravery.
To get a better understanding of the social aspect of this incident, I talked to a sociologist who noted that Martyr al-Daghi's brave act should be venerated by the people.
Here you see a citizen who acts based on his social responsibility as he observes a crime being committed. He has social commitment. This is very valuable, especially at a time when the global trend is individualism and people are after their own interests. Now a member of the society has stood up to defend another person and identifies with her. We must recognize this brave act and introduce this person as a role model to the society.
While a CCTV video showing the moment of Aldariz's stabbing has gone viral, some anti-Iran media have tried to use it to attack the Islamic Republic's values. To get a better understanding of this, I asked Mr. Asghari about their intention.
Another aspect of this incident is that in social media you observe a rather different approach toward this brave act. Some media outlets follow frameworks that do not support Iran's national interests. The martyrdom of Hamidreza Aldaghi has once again unified Iranian society. However, we see anti-Iran media try to use every incident to polarize the society, cause enmity among people, and increase anger in the society.
Acts of sheer courage by the Iranian nation that are based on moral and social responsibility have foiled anti-Iran media campaigns. Hamidreza Aldaghi's martyrdom is a case in point that proves Iranians are always ready to give their lives to safeguard their values. Mahdi Abbasian, Tehran.
Palestinian popular resistance committees say the crimes of Israel will further strengthen the resistance. Israeli forces killed 3 Palestinians, injuring 4 during a raid into the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. The slain Palestinians carried out an anti-regime operation in the Jordan Valley last month, which led to the death of 3 Israeli soldiers. The regime also killed a Palestinian woman during a separate attack in the town of Hawara. Israel claims the woman was shot dead after she stabbed and injured an Israeli settler. Earlier, we were joined by our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandil, for more details on the Israeli raid in the occupied West Bank city of Nablus.
The Israeli military claimed that its forces, the Israeli Shin Bet, as well as special forces, raided the Yasemin neighborhood in the old town of Nablus, surrounded a building. The Israeli military claimed that wanted Palestinians were hiding inside this building and that they accused them for carrying out the shooting on the 7th of April near Jericho Ariha that led to the killing of 3 Israeli settlers at that day. The Israeli military claimed that they used an explosive drone in order to carry out the assassination. 2 of those who were killed during this operation were members of the Hamas movement, and that they moved to Nablus and received cover from the Lion's Den group in Nablus, according, of course, to the Israeli military. The 3rd Palestinian who were killed during this operation and was inside the building as well, the Israeli military claimed that he was a key accomplice to those two. The military operation to Nablus has ended.
Earlier, Professor of Political Science at Al-Azhar University, Mohammer Abusara, said Israel's Nablus operation amounts to extrajudicial killing and the execution of Palestinians.
What happened this morning in the old city of Nablus is considered an extrajudicial killing and execution of Palestinian resistance fighters, who Israel allegedly make them responsible for the killing of 3 Israeli settlers on April 7th of last month, when a settler car was ambushed by Palestinian resistance fighters and killed the whole family, the mother and 2 daughters in that incident. This operation has been praised, unfortunately, by Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu, who praised the operation, and senior Israeli officials or members of the Israeli army called the operation was carried out with precision and professionalism, that the killing of 3 Palestinians is considered by the spokesperson for the Israeli army as precision and professionalism. And as I just mentioned, this is an extrajudicial killing of Palestinian people, Palestinian fighters. The source of the problem is the continuation of the Israeli occupation, which has been going on for more than 55 years now, and Palestinian resistance fighters are fighting back. They're fighting for their freedom. They're fighting for their independence.
Russia has accused the U.S. of being behind a drone strike on the Kremlin, which officials in Moscow say was aimed at killing President Vladimir Putin. The Kremlin spokesman said Russia is aware of the plot, knows that Washington is selecting the targets, and that Ukraine is merely implementing them. Dmitry Peskov added that Russia is considering various options to respond that meet the interests of the country. The U.S. dismissed Russia's allegation, saying that Moscow's assertion was a lie. Russia has already blamed the attack on Ukraine, describing it as a failed terrorist act. Kiev has rejected the accusation. Meanwhile, Russian missiles targeted the Ukrainian capital, Kiev, again. Ukrainian officials said the southern Zaporizhzhia region and the port city of Odessa were also shelled by the Russian military. A correspondent in Moscow, Johnny Miller, earlier told us that the drone attack on the Kremlin might draw serious response from Russia.
Well, yes, as you say, Russia accuses Ukraine of carrying it out. Ukraine says that, or at least the president says that it wasn't them. Former Russian President Medvedev has said that now that after this attack, Russia should target or eliminate Zelensky. This may well prove a change of Russian policy in perhaps looking at regime change, looking at getting rid of Zelensky rather than demilitarizing Ukraine and forcing them to cede territory, which was the aim in the past. So this event, we'll have to wait and see what Russia's response is, how seriously they take it, whether they try to downplay it, or whether they strike back in a stronger manner. Of course, there's many buildings, decision-making centers in the center of Kiev, the president's office, the parliament, which Russia hasn't attempted to strike yet.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The pro-Israel lobby groups in the West have over the years made desperate attempts to silence and tame people, university professors, and independent global news networks over their coverage of Israeli regime crimes against Palestinians. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for the first part, please. The Electronic Intifada wrote in this regard, a Palestinian-American teacher is planning to sue a Pennsylvania university after Israeli lobby groups pressured the institution to fire him. After being fired again from another college months later, he believes he is now blacklisted from teaching. Karim Tanous taught for 2 years as a professor of business on tenure track at Cabrini University, a private college near Philadelphia. He regularly criticizes Israel and its ideology, Zionism, on his personal Twitter account. But I didn't preach this at the school. I didn't even talk about it, Tanous told the Electronic Intifada, adding that he consistently received high evaluations from his students and was known for making the material engaging and accessible. However, the Jewish Federation of Greater Philadelphia and the Jewish Community Relations Council sent letters to the Cabrini administration last year seeking to censure Tanous and have him fired over his personal tweets. Israeli lobby groups such as the Jewish Federations of North America and its local chapters have been prominent forces in the push to shut down criticism of the Zionist regime on campuses. It is also a major force behind the promotion of the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, IHRA, highly controversial definition of anti-Semitism, which conflates criticism of the Zionist regime on the one hand with anti-Jewish bigotry on the other. The IHRA definition has become Israeli lobbies' key weapon in North America and Europe to enforce censorship about the Zionist regime's crimes against Palestinians. The Federation demanded that Tanuz should face consequences for spreading what they said and claimed anti-Semitic and anti-Israel commentary and making posts in support of the destruction of Israel, according to a recent article in the Philadelphia Inquirer. Meanwhile, a Twitter account and website with a history of relentlessly harassing Palestinians and other advocates for Palestinian rights also began targeting Tanuz. The blacklisting group StopAntisemitism.org named him last July as Anti-Semite of the Week. A month before he was fired from Cabrini, the website encouraged its followers to email the university administration and submit an ethnic discrimination complaint against Tanuz. During a meeting before the semester started, according to Tanuz, the administration seemed to believe the Israeli lobby group's claims. But he explained that his tweets in defense of Palestinian liberation are not hate speech. It's all political speech, and you can't call political speech hate speech. Nevertheless, the college terminated him in August. Now, Tanuz's lawyer, Mark Schwartz, says that they will file a lawsuit on the grounds that Cabrini discriminated against Tanuz and violated his First Amendment rights. After being fired from Cabrini, Tanuz then started a teaching position at nearby Gwinnett Mercy University in January. But he was notified within his first week on the job that he was being fired. In its termination letter to Tanuz, the college's Human Resources Department said it had received a complaint from a community member who shared an article written about you suggesting that your tweets were anti-Semitic. The administration claimed that Tanuz could be biased against students due to their religious beliefs, though it made no allegation that he had discriminated against students in any way. After being dismissed by Gwinnett Mercy, Tanuz said, "It fired my lawyer up even more. Being terminated by two universities shows that I am being blacklisted for my speech, and that's against my civil rights," he said. Schwartz said, "Their lawsuit will have precedent, and that's he is confident in Tanuz's case." He cited the case of Stephen Salaita, who was fired by the University of Illinois at Urbana campaign in 2014 for social media comments criticizing the Zionist regime's assault on Gaza that year. Schwartz noted, Salaita said that he was unemployable, and this is now the case with Karim. Salaita sued the university for breach of contract, alleging administrators acted under pressure from pro-Israel donors, later settling the case. Schwartz also noted the recent reversal by Harvard University of its decision to withdraw an offer of a fellowship to Kenneth Roth, the former director of Human Rights Watch. The school's dean, Douglas Elmendorf, blocked the fellowship in December due to pressure, Roth charged, from pro-Israel donors unhappy about Human Rights Watch criticism of the apartheid regime. But amid outrage at what was widely perceived as censorship of criticism of the Zionist regime, the prestigious college reinstated its offer to Roth in January. Schwartz told the Electronic Intifada, Harvard had the good sense to reverse itself. Maybe some of the inferior universities will give pause. A university is supposed to be a marketplace of ideas. What happened to Tanous is just intolerable.
This is A to Z. An introduction to an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, how to get rid of feeling of despair. In the name of God, the most gracious, the most merciful, may his peace and blessings be upon Muhammad and his pure immaculate Ahlul Bayt. Salamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. You are listening to A to Z on IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. We start our session today with a question. A person has asked, I am a young man. I have been involved in a great scene, feeling scene on the one hand, and my weak determination before my loss on the other hand have made me desperate of the forgiveness of Allah, and I feel that I will definitely be in hell. At the same time, I fear that I'm not right in this opinion, thankfully. Would you please guide me to the right solution? It's a very important question, and it can be a very common question among the youths. And also the answer would be helpful, inshallah. In answer, the very first step that we should have it in our mind is to confess our sin before Allah. We have to confess. This is the first step of repentance. Confessing is the first step of repentance. So we're going to confess our sin before Allah and pray to him to help us with a real repentance. We do not need to ask for forgiveness with a difficult language. Speak easily and spontaneously and say what is inside us in any way you can, because Allah knows what is in our heart even before it come to our tongue. So this is the very first step of repentance, confessing, because confessing, when you confess, you accept by your heart that you have done something wrong. And when you confess that you have something wrong, it gains the forgiveness of Allah. Welcome back, dear brothers and sisters. You're listening to A to Z on IRIB English Radio. Okay, in the previous part, we talked about the first step of repentance, and that was confessing our sin before Allah and pray him, not with a very difficult language. But the second step is something that we have bear in our mind and know well, that despairing of the forgiveness of Allah is a sin even greater than the sin we are originally involved in, because despair opens the door wider before us to commit all sins, and it is this that will get us into the hell, not our first sin. It's very important. Despair is the key of opening the hellfire towards ourselves. Therefore, Islam has considered despairing of Allah's mercy as the greatest of sins. It is that Satan, the first enemy of man, wants for us on the day of judgment. So, as a young man, if you're looking for a true repentance, we should fill our heart with a big hope of getting the forgiveness of Allah and try determinedly not to commit the sin again. When we commit a sin, we should hasten immediately to Allah and ask Him to forgive us. We should never cut our relation with Allah in any case. If we go to east or west, we shall not find a God like our Lord, like our Allah, whom we disobey, but He all the able to punish us at once, grants us a respite, and says that He loves those who ask Him for forgiveness, loves the repentant, and loves to purify themselves, besides the loves to reward us with His paradise if we turn to Him sincerely. And I hope everyone in life full of hope and without feeling of despair.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to RIB English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, RIB English Radio.
Hidden Files.
Well, there's a distinct and qualitative difference between one breaking a law for one's own individual self-interest or violating it in the interests of a class or a people whose oppression is expressed either directly or indirectly through that particular law. Well, the former might be called a criminal, though in many instances he is a victim. But the latter, as a reformist or revolutionary, is interested in universal social change. Captured, he or she is a political prisoner. Well, this is an excerpt from writings by former political prisoner, black revolutionary activist and professor Dr. Angela Davis. Hello, and welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Well, you heard the definition of who is a political prisoner, according to this philosopher and activist. But the United States denies ever having any political prisoners. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of individuals who've been incarcerated in the U.S. over the decades who would say otherwise. Now, some of them have now died in prison. Some have been released, and others are still incarcerated after being in prison for more than four decades. Now, many of these individuals were involved in revolutionary movements in the 1960s, At the time, most of the activists were teenagers, or in their 20s, imagine that. Now, they say that they were fighting against settler colonialism and oppression. Now, these individuals are elderly in their 60s, 70s, and even 80s. They have endured many decades in prison and have spent much of their time even in solitary confinement. Many of them are ill, and lawyers have petitioned for them to be released on the basis of compassion. However, the U.S. is still adamant about keeping them behind bars. Why?
Why American authorities felt that the Black Panthers were such a threat, and the reason why the U.S. destroyed this group and many other black nationalist groups. What exactly were they demanding? They wanted freedom and the power to determine the destiny of black and oppressed communities. The group believed that self-determination was key to ending their oppression, and they wanted to control the institutions in their communities. The Black Panthers were also seeking full employment for African Americans and other people of color. Due to the fact that black communities had been exploited for hundreds of years, the group wanted an end to the theft by the capitalist system of black people. They believed that the U.S. government was racist and prevented black Americans from excelling. They demanded what was promised to them after slavery, and that was 40 acres of land and two mules, or the financial equivalent of it. The Black Panthers wanted decent housing for black people and other minorities, housing which was fit to live in. And the group was also demanding that decent education be provided to black Americans. They wanted what they called true history to be taught, which meant exposing the true nature of American imperialism, as well as teaching the reality of how black Americans had been exploited and how they contributed to society. The Black Panthers were looking at many aspects of life, including health, and they wanted free health care for all black and oppressed people. And they wanted preventive medicine to be practiced in oppressed communities. One of the first demands of the Black Panthers was an end to police brutality and the murder of black people and other oppressed people inside the United States. The Black Panthers were very aware of the connection between their own oppression and the oppression of others. Thus, they wanted an end to all wars of aggression by the United States. They said the goal of these wars was to expand domination and the oppression of people around the world. The organizations wanted the freedom for all black and oppressed people being held in all U.S. prisons. The Panthers felt that to begin with, their incarceration was due to the racist and oppressive system. And they also believed that any trials held for alleged crimes should be done so in front of a jury of peers. To sum it up, what the Black Panthers wanted for their people and others were land, bread, housing, education, clothing, justice, peace, and people's community control of modern technology. Had these demands been met, it would have ensured the liberation, independence, and advancement of the black community in the United States. However, the imperialist capitalist system is not designed to liberate the oppressed, but to gain the ultimate benefit from their oppression.
Well, I would like to welcome a former U.S. political prisoner to Hidden Files, who was incarcerated for 49 years.
Jalil Montarem, former member of the Black Panthers Party, which he joined at 16, and founding member of the Jericho Movement for Political Prisoners. He was incarcerated at age 19, and he was freed at age 69. He spent almost 15 years in prison. He was released in October of 2020. Jalil Montarem established the first revolutionary newspaper from prison and continues to be active. He started from inside prison, a national campaign to recognize political prisoners. He also started a UN petition against the U.S. having political prisoners.
Well, thank you for joining us here at Hidden Files, Mr. Montarem. How do you define a political prisoner?
How do we bring these categories and define who they are as a result of their resistance of being dissenters to a system of white supremacy and capitalist imperialism? For us, our comrades are freedom fighters, right? They identify them as being terrorists. Why are they terrorists? Because they're opposing the ideals and the practices of white supremacy and capitalist imperialism. Right? They are trying to alleviate our oppression, right, by any means necessary, as El Hajj Malik Shabazz has instructed us, by any means necessary. And so therefore they criminalize us, right, and bring us to criminal court in order to charge us what they call criminal offenses, right, on their books, right, in order to protect their interests, protect the state, right? And so this is the reason why they don't want to identify us as political prisoners, because they criminalize our movement. They criminalize our people. They criminalize our movement, right? We've been engaged in a war against black people since 1619, right, if you really want to understand it, all right? When they had the black codes, they had Jim Crow, right? And they have mass incarceration, right? The school-to-prison pipeline, right? It's all criminalizing our lives, right? Our efforts to be actually totally free and emancipated, right, of people. And so that is the reason why they criminalize us, don't want to give us recognition, right, and understanding that there is divisions in this country, right, as a result of white supremacy, capitalist imperialism, past and race divisions in this country, and that there are people grappling with this idea that at some point in time, we have to free ourselves from a system that has been oppressing us for the last 400 years.
Well, from your experience, do you think that political prisoners are treated differently than the average prisoner?
We find that political prisoners are naturally distinguished from the regular general prison population. And the reason why is because they're educated. They're educated and they understand the nature of their relationship to the state. And therefore, they try to remove those individuals from the population because they do not want the general population to be educated and understand what is their relationship to the state, in regards to being an antagonistic relationship they have with the state, particularly based upon race and class. And so for me, naturally being an organizer in prison, I haven't been organized outside prison, been organized inside prison, I often was targeted by prison officials to be put in solitary confinement and or have other types of harassments and being deprived of certain privileges that most prisoners get. They would deprive me of that. But the only thing that did make me stronger, made me fight harder, that's all.
Well, do you think that it has been proven to the international community that political prisoners exist in the U.S., though Washington denies it?
Excellent question. You are absolutely correct. The United States does not recognize the fact that they do have political prisoners. When I first put in my, I'll give you an example. When I first submitted my campaign, U.S. Petition campaign to the United Nations, this was back in the late 1970s, early 1980s, I had the opportunity to have a question asked of then U.N. ambassador to the United Nations by a guy named by the name of Andrew Young, the first black U.N. ambassador to the United Nations under the presidency of Jimmy Carter. And the question I had asked him by a journalist who was, when he was in Paris having a press conference, was, does political prisoners exist in the United States? And Andrew Young answered in the affirmative, positively, said perhaps thousands. You can Google New York Times, Andrew Young, political prisoners, and all those articles will come up. He was vilified in the press, by the elite for having made that truthful statement, that perhaps thousands of political prisoners in the United States. And he was called to the carpet in the White House and told him to shut that down. Why do they do that? They do that because they don't want the world to know that there is dissent in the United States, right? They project themselves as being the moral humanitarian leader of the world, and that is a false. That's a falsehood, right? They are the greatest harbinger of and progeny of violence in the world. Not my words; those are the words of Dr. Martin Luther King prior to his being assassinated. He said the United States is the greatest progenitor of violence in the world, and we understand that. We know that.
Well, do you see a connection between the oppression of black Americans and the oppression of people worldwide?
One of the things I told the community, international community, that their freedom depends mostly on our freedom, like black people's freedom in the United States, right? I informed them specifically that when we are free, you will be free, right? Mm-hmm. Why is that? because we are in the bastion of white supremacy. You see? And so for us, if this empire, what we call the United States, which is in fact is an empire, right? Well, an octopus, right? You can see the tentacles all over the world, right? Where they're sucking the blood and sucking the resources and sucking the labor from various, particularly mostly people of color countries around the world, right? Now, those who engage in struggles for national liberation and independence to end colonialism, neocolonialism, oftentimes they'll cut off the tentacles, right, of the octopus, right, to free themselves. But what happens? The tentacles grow back, right? And in a period of time, the tentacles grow back, like what happened in Chile and Salvador Allende, right, mm-hmm. as an example, when Pinochet took over after they freed themselves. And the same thing happened in various other parts of the world. Why is that? Because the head has not been dealt with, the head of the octopus, right? We are in the head of the octopus, okay? So therefore, as long as the head of the octopus maintains itself, right, then they continue to create the conditions from which they can reassert themselves in those struggles, in those moves that were successful at some point in time. All right, so for us, it is imperative that the world know that the international community, progressive international community, understands that what they're dealing with around the world is white supremacy, capitalist imperialism, but we're in the bastion. We're in the heart of it, right? We're in the belly of the beast. And therefore, our struggle, ultimately, when we are successful, inshallah, when we are successful, the world will also be free.
Well, fortunately, you are no longer in prison, but can you tell us more about the overall conditions of these prisoners even as we speak?
Imam Jamil Al-Amin, right, who they know is innocent of the crime that he committed, but because of his history of resistance, they had to lock him in the prison system. Right? He's been in ever since, almost 22 years now. Right? They know he's innocent. The guy who committed the crime for which he was convicted of confessed. All right? But they hold him in prison because of his politics, or who he is as a political person. Another individual is Varon Zambaro. Right? This individual was part of the Black Liberation Army, part of the movement back in the days. He did his time. Was on his way out the front door, had gotten parole, had received parole, on his way out the front door, and Anthony Gonzalez, who was Attorney General of the United States at the time, called the prison and told them, don't release him. He's still in prison today, right, because of his politics, not because of anything else he's done on. He did his time. He guaranteed parole, right, and they won't let him go, won't release him. Another individual, of course, is Rushel McGee. Rushel McGee is the oldest political prisoner that we have in the United States today. Right, and he was involved in the 1970 insurrection, August 1910 insurrection with Jonathan Jackson, George's younger brother, at the Bryan County Courthouse. Right, he was found not guilty of shooting and he was involved in that incident. Not guilty by the court. The court would not accept that decision from the jury. Would not accept it. Right, he's still in prison today. Right, Mumia Abdul-Jamal. We know that he did not commit the crime for which he was committed. He's known around the world as a profound intellect, right, inside prison and outside of prison, right? They know he was innocent for what he did. They won't let him out of prison. We've had comrades who died in prison on their deathbed, and they won't release him for compassionate release, so they'll be dying at home, right, because of their politics. One particularly, Mutulu Shakur, right, the stepfather of the great rapper Tupac Shakur, right? He's terminally ill today, right? He asked for compassionate release several times, and they denied him. Or probably martial law, he's going to die in prison, okay? This is how they treat us, political prisoners and prisoners of war.
Oh, really appreciate you being with us here at Hidden Files, Mr. Jalil Motaki. Now, let's take a closer look at some of the political prisoners that were mentioned by our guests.
Assata Shakur. She is the step-aunt and godmother of late rapper Tupac Shakur and the sister of political prisoner Dr. Mutulu Shakur. She is 75 years old. Under U.S. President Obama's term, not only was she not pardoned, but the bail on her head increased from $1 million to $2 million. Dr. Mutulu Shakur. He is a doctor who specializes in acupuncture. He was very effective in helping people get off of drugs using his method. He was a Black liberation activist. He's also the stepfather of rapper Tupac Shakur. he was charged and convicted for helping his sister Asada escape prison. He was eligible for parole in 2016, and despite being a model prisoner, his release has been denied. Currently, he's suffering from stage 3 bone marrow cancer, and he is 71 years old. There have been many requests made for him to be released on humanitarian reasons, but they all have been denied. Rochelle Sink McGee. Rochelle is the oldest political prisoner in the United States. He's 83 years old. He has only lived 16 years outside of prisons. The rest of his life he has spent behind bars. From the beginning, he was convicted of trumped-up charges based on racism. He says slavery 400 years ago and slavery today is the same, just with a new name. Momia Abu Jamal. Momia Abu Jamal is an internationally recognized journalist and black liberation activist. He was one of the founding members of the Philadelphia chapter of Black Panthers, and he has been known as the voice of the voiceless for his many years spent writing about issues relating to working-class people of color, prisoners, and the underrepresented. He has written 8 books and countless articles and commentaries from a prison cell on death row in Pennsylvania. He has been incarcerated since 1981. He's 68 years old and suffering from various diseases. Imam Jamil al-Amin. Formerly known as H-Rap Brown, he served as Minister of Justice with the Black Panthers. He is a well-known Muslim leader now and has been in prison since 2000. He remains in jail despite another man admitting to killing the person al-Amin was accused of killing.
Over the years, there have been many political prisoners to die in prison or to be released and to die within days of their release in the United States. There are petitions and movements around the world asking for compassionate releases for these aging revolutionaries. Well, we will continue to follow it up right here and let you know about their latest situation. But for now, I'd like to leave you with this quote from journalist and political prisoner Momia Abu Jamal. Conventional wisdom would have one believe that it is insane to resist this, the mightiest of empires. But what history really shows is that today's empire is tomorrow's ashes, that nothing lasts forever, and that to not resist is to acquiesce in your own oppression. Well, the greatest form of sanity that anyone can exercise is to resist that force that is trying to repress, oppress, and fight down the human spirit. Until next time, we hope that we hear from you. I'm Marzia Hashimi, and this is Hidden Files.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.